The following paid program does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the staff and management of Tri-Scepter Productions or the Superhuman Channel. Tri-Scepter Productions and the Superhuman Channel are not responsible for any claims, warranties, or guarantees made during this program.
Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled.
From the studio gym where excuses never apply.
It's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Yes, yes, it's Monday. Most people hate Mondays, but I love Mondays because I can't wait to get back into the studio and behind the mic, and we've got a great show planned today. You know that the mantra for the past few weeks that I've been promoting to people is never forget, never forget, never forget. When we talk about nutrition, when we talk about health in general, we talk about modalities of training, when we talk about medicine, I say never forget because we too soon forget the past. And the past has a lot more great information in it than some studies that are coming out today that are designed just to promote whatever the agenda du jour happens to be. You always have to compare things against what you know, not abandon what you know for what you're hearing now. And in the spirit of that, we've got two great shows planned today, two great hours of programming. The first hour, we're going to be talking with Peter Unger, distinguished professor and chair with the Department of Anthropology over at the University of Arkansas about a recent paper that was published that we're going to call What Was Really on the Menu for Early Humans. We do a lot of shows on ancestral diets and Paleolithic nutrition, but a lot of it is just postulated. We don't know. We weren't there. And hopefully we're going to learn more about what his group has found out that our paleo ancestors and early humans were actually eating. Later in the show, Professor Kenneth Federer, from the Central Connecticut State University, professor of archaeology over there. We're doing a show called The Canary in the Mine, Similarities to Lost Civilizations and the Current U.S. Conditions. I've wanted to do this show for some time, and I'm glad we're doing it today. Okay, so I will welcome my first guest, and that is Professor Peter Unger. How you doing, Peter?
I'm doing great.
Fantastic. Okay, so as you heard during the intro, we've done numerous shows. We've had lots of great people on the show. Everybody from Dr. Lauren Cordain to Matt Lalonde, Rob Wolf, and even though she has not appeared on the show, she has spoken to me numerous times and counseled me on paleo nutritional facts, Leslie Aiello from the Winogren Foundation. And we've always been intrigued by paleo styles of eating on this show ever since I started. But the reality is we really don't know what paleo humans were eating because we can only guess. But your group has attempted to find a methodology to truly understand this. Can you explain how you determined what early humans were eating first? Because I think that's really intriguing.
Sure. Well, what I think is most important to start with is the fact that we really don't know the specific items that were on the menu. We can begin to get at some of the details, like whether the foods that they were eating, what kind of plants in terms of were they grass-related plants, were they tree-related plants, and that depends on the kind of carbon that we find in the human ancestors themselves. And also, what were sort of the physical properties of the foods? Are they foods that are hard and brittle or foods that are soft and tough? And from there, we can speculate as to what the human ancestors might have eaten more specifically. But as far as me being able to tell you what the glycemic index was of a Homo erectus, that far we cannot go.
No, and I don't expect that by any means. But we do know some things already. While a lot of people promote Paleolithic style eating, and it's becoming quite the rage now, there is evidence that points to the fact that we really cannot try to eat like our paleo ancestors because the quality and nature of food has changed. Leslie Aiello pointed out to me that in early humans who came upon an apple, it wasn't the apple of today. It was some small, green, very tough, probably very tart, devoid of a lot of the sugar. But we have raised our food, for lack of better terms, to embrace the things we like, like the sweetness and the juiciness of it. So food is morphed. It's not the food that our early humans were exposed to. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, that certainly is true. Domestication and agribusiness and things of that nature have certainly affected the kinds of foods that we eat. And perhaps it's more reasonable to talk about what our ancestors didn't eat than what they did.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit of that. What didn't they eat that we are eating more of today, you think?
Well, clearly anything, the cereal grains is something that Lauren Cordain and many others have spoken about now for decades and decades. The marbled meats, the fatty, other fatty products, things of that nature certainly would not have been available to our distant ancestors. Cheeseburgers and milkshakes would not have been something that Homo erectus would have consumed, for sure.
Yeah, but I want to focus on something for a moment, because I always get a lot of strange looks when I talk to people about, quote-unquote, the term healthy nutrition takes so many different forms today that it's very confusing to people. And a lot of times I'll say to people, look, we were never designed to eat grains. We didn't know how to mill them and process them and make them edible. These were food alternatives in an effort to try to feed large numbers of people. And these were not primary foods of our early ancestors. And they will look at me and they'll go, well, that's ridiculous, because back in the days of the Romans, they were making bread, and the Egyptians were making bread. And I say, yes, exactly, because they were trying to feed large numbers of people who found them way into major cities, if you will, for lack of better terms. And they couldn't feed them what was best. They had to feed them what they could.
Well, that's absolutely true. One of the issues that we need to remember, I think, is the fact that when we talk about the evolution of human diet, there's always this question about whose diet. You know, are we talking about the diet of the common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees 5 million years ago or 6 million years ago? Are we talking about the diet of the very earliest members of our own genus Homo at 2.5 billion years ago, the earliest members of our own species at 175,000 years ago? Or are we talking about the diet at the time of the Neolithic or agricultural revolution at 10,000 years ago? So I think part of the issue is, when we ask the question, what are we designed to eat? What did our ancestors evolve to eat? We need to sort of take a step back and realize, well, you know, which ancestors are we referring to?
I think personally the ancestors that I'm most interested in would be the early humans, not necessarily further back than there. When I say, I guess, I'm talking about either the 2.5 million year point that you spoke of, because that is still, we were still kind of pristine and eating what we were genetically predisposed to eat, what our intention led us to eat, as opposed to what we had to make available because of famine or then later on the agricultural revolution started to market to us.
Sure.
I mean, would you agree that was still, we were still in the realm of a more, you know, again, another word that has been hijacked, natural, a more natural diet, a diet that we were predisposed to eat genetically?
Well, yes, I suppose I would. The one of the big issues, though, is what's going on with us genetically right now. And if you look at things like the amylase gene, it seems like over the last 10,000 years, we have sort of begun to evolve the ability to consume grains more than, say, somebody 10,000 years ago would have been able to. And likewise, the fact that we, most of us, are able to digest milk sugar into adulthood also sort of speaks to that as well.
But does that make it good? I think that if you or I were prisoners of a society, and our children were prisoners of that society, and they fed us cellulose from wood, we would probably find a way, because it's every cell in our body is driven to survive. So our body would find a way through mutation and changes to survive on cellulose exclusively. But that doesn't make it right, and that doesn't make it optimal, does it?
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. I'm not quite sure what optimal means in this context, but
I think to me, optimal means a diet that does not promote disease. I think that would be, for me, what optimal would mean. A diet that is complementary and does not necessarily promote disease, other than the normal wear and tear of digesting food and oxidative stress that occurs naturally from any digestive process. But other than that, no extrinsic effects on the promotion of disease. That's what optimal means to me.
Okay. Fair enough.
So are we talking about 2.5 million years ago then?
Probably we're talking about, from that perspective, if you're thinking about chronic degenerative diseases and things of that nature, you're
yes.
probably talking about before about 10,000 years ago, I would imagine.
Oh, okay. That's even better. Okay. So let's do this. Let's take a quick commercial break and let's dig into what your group started to learn when you started to dig into this. We're talking with Professor Peter Unger about the menu of our early human ancestors. You're listening to Super Human Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Testosterone is the king of anabolic hormones, and TestCharge is unlike any testosterone amplifier you have ever tried, because only TestCharge has taxadrol, a substance that grows in only one place in the world and is only found in TestCharge. TestCharge will jack your testosterone levels like illegal agents, but rest assured, there are no banned substances in TestCharge. TestCharge is the secret weapon used by IFBB legend Flex Wheeler. And now you can join the pro ranks. Go to AAEFX.com to learn more about where you can find TestCharge today. When you take real performance-enhancing supplements, your body is placed under a lot of stress. Your organs need support. If you had to take a supplement for each of the potential side effects, estrogen conversion, blood pressure, liver protection, cholesterol control, water retention, androgen receptor upregulation, kidney function, and much more, you'd have to break the bank just to pay for it all. That's until Need to Build Muscle's N2 Guard. N2 Guard does all of this and more. It's the only real cycle support supplement that you'll ever need. Look, if your organs are important to you, buy N2 Guard today at needtobuildmuscle.com. Testosterone is the king of anabolic hormones, and TestCharge is unlike any testosterone amplifier you have ever tried, because only TestCharge has taxadrol, a substance that grows in only one place in the world and is only found in TestCharge. TestCharge will jack your testosterone levels like illegal agents, but rest assured, there are no banned substances in TestCharge. TestCharge is the secret weapon used by IFBB legend Flex Wheeler. And now you can join the pro ranks. Go to AAEFX.com to learn more about where you can find TestCharge today.
There are a few products that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing. My near vision has improved, and I can read small print from 8 inches. My overall vision is clearer, and the glare from oncoming headlights doesn't bother me any longer. Just 1 to 2 drops a day, and the results are visible. You can find CanSee eye drops at wisechoicemedicine.net or call 800-861-4936. That's 800-861-4936. WiseChoiceMedicine.net. CanSee Eye Drops. The name says it all.
You already know how great the Testo 100 Transdermal Testosterone Boosting Patch is. Well, now it's even better. The new and improved Testo 100 patch now contains diaspartic acid, stinging nettle root, and androstenotrione to increase free testosterone while reducing sex hormone binding globulin and aromatase enzyme. It's still made in FDA-certified labs and contains all the great ingredients that made it work originally, but now it's even better, bypassing the stomach to deliver its ingredients throughout the day for greater increases in energy, libido, and muscle building fat burning effects. Get 50% off when you use the coupon code SHR4. Go to AGEFORCE.com and use the coupon code SHR4 and get your new Testo 100 patch today.
That's the sound of 37 dumbbells. That's a lot of weight and a lot of wasted space when you can get the same thing done with just one set of power blocks. The new, quieter, urethane series power blocks with FlexPin technology are the heaviest and easiest to use quick change dumbbells on the market. Starting at just $149 a pair, power blocks can grow as your strength grows, all the way up to 130 pounds per dumbbell. Imagine a whole rack of dumbbells in the space of just one pair with power blocks. Go to powerblock.com today or call 800-651-1937. Power Block, the world's best dumbbell.
Listen strong. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. I just received a message from Quest Protein Bar. They will be announcing their new flavor today on their Facebook page in 1 hour at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Go to Quest Bar Facebook page to learn what the new flavor will be. Their flavors are unbelievable. If you have not tried the Quest Protein Bar yet, You can get two free bars by going to superhumanradio.com and clicking the Quest Protein Bar banner ad. My guest this hour is Professor Peter Unger. We're talking about what early humans ate. We talk about this quite often, and we're going to hope to elucidate a little clearer what was on the menu back then. Okay, so Professor Unger, what did your group find out when you started to add? Did you not only analyze the bones, but you analyzed the actual teeth surfaces, correct?
That's correct. We looked at the scratches and pits on the teeth, and we looked at the chemistry of the enamel in the teeth.
Was there any evidence that our early humans were brushing with fluoridated toothpaste back then?
There wasn't very much evidence that they were brushing with anything. Although what's interesting is we find virtually no evidence of any caries or associated diseases.
Okay. And that's what Dr. Weston A. Price learned. Are you familiar with Price's work, early work? He was a dentist from Ohio who did some what do they call that? Missionary work in some other countries with native aborigines, and found that they had healthier teeth than the people back in the United States. So he closed his practice and began to travel the world to unlock the reason for this. And what it came down to was nutrition. What we were eating here in the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s was causing decay. But these primitives had no tooth decay whatsoever.
Well, this we know for sure. We're pretty confident that if you look at foraging peoples, traditional societies, what we typically find is we find that their teeth are, generally speaking, in much better shape than ours as far as decay goes, as far as dental crowding goes, as far as malocclusion goes, as far as gingival disease, periodontal disease, and so on. And that's certainly related to our diets.
Okay, was there any evidence, and I know this is kind of an off-the-hand question here, but was there any evidence that these humans were cooking or eating raw when it came to animal proteins and animal fats?
Well, the earliest evidence we have for cooking in the fossil record, in my opinion, and of course different people have different opinions on this, but I think if you were to poll most paleoanthropologists, you'd find that the earliest sort of definitive evidence that everybody can agree on is something on the order of 750,000 years ago.
And wow.
Controlled fire actually means cooking, typically.
So we've been cooking a lot longer than we think we have.
Well, we've been cooking a lot longer than there have been modern humans. And by the time we get to Neanderthals, there's tons and tons and tons of fire pits.
Okay. So what were our early human ancestors actually eating? Do you have the ability to tell us what their diet was predominated by? Is it true that it was predominantly animal proteins and animal fats?
Again, it's going to really depend upon which human ancestors we're talking about. Sort of, to me, the most important, from your perspective, and from the perspective of this audience, the most important time period that we're referring to is really the last 2.5 million years or so.
Okay.
And what we typically see is we see this major shift at about 2.5 million years ago. We get stone tools coming into the archaeological record for the first time. We get cut marks on bones that indicate that those tools are being used for butchering animals. The proportions of the bones we get at the sites the human ancestors are found at tell us that they're actually dragging back fleshy limbs and things of that nature to the sites. So that doesn't exclude the possibility that these tools are also being used to process plants.
Right.
But I think what's really important here is the idea that what we're seeing is an increase in the breadth of types of foods that are available to our ancestors because of our use of tools. And what we found in our study is a couple of things. First, we found that when we look at the scratches and pits on the teeth, we see a much broader range of patterns. As we cross that threshold from 2.5 million years onward, we see our ancestors taking a much broader and broader variety of foods than we had previous to that. We see that in terms of the scratches and pits, and we see that in terms of the ratios of the different types of carbon. That are found in the teeth. In terms of some are related to the consumption of sedges and grasses. Others are related to the consumption of trees and bushes, or at least their products.
A lot of people claim that our early human ancestors had a higher ratio of omega-3s, which we know are anti-inflammatory fats, to the more pro-inflammatory fats like omega-6s, which is exactly the opposite of today's diet. Did your research show any evidence of that, or is that something you really can't tell?
I can't tell. I think it is certainly possible, but I think that's sort of in the domain at this point of speculation, at least from the fossil evidence.
Okay. Is there any way to determine if inflammation occurred in early humans by observing the fossil remains? Is there any footprint that inflammation leaves behind for us to look at?
Well, there are some diet-related diseases that can be identified in the fossil record. Inflammation is not clearly nothing that has anything to do with soft tissue can be identified in the fossil record.
Right.
But there are some things that can be identified. I'm not sure inflammation per se, but we can, for example, look for things like hypervitaminosis A. We can look for things like, evidence of rickets, evidence of other sort of vitamin deficiency related diseases.
What did you find out about vitamin A?
Well, it's interesting, there's actually one specimen that's been identified of Homo erectus that seems to have had too much vitamin A.
Is this based on region and availability to certain, like for instance, was this in a cold climate where they may have been eating polar bear liver, for instance?
Well, that's actually a really, really good observation. In fact, in this case, it was in sub-Saharan Africa. It was right in the heartland of where humans probably evolved, in Kenya. And this particular individual, it's speculated, did in fact consume carnivore liver before it died, and he probably died from that.
So the vitamin A toxicity killed this person, you're saying, or just the liver in general, you're saying?
Well, that's vitamin A toxicity was the differential diagnosis given at Johns Hopkins when this was done. Actually, it was done a long time ago, back in the 1980s.
Wow, that's amazing. What about vitamin D? Was there any evidence that our early ancestors understood the value of sunlight, and was there any evidence of higher levels of D3 in their body as compared to today?
Well, that's sort of beyond the evidence. We really can't even speculate on that. Although certainly, for most of early human evolution and where modern humans evolved, we're talking about equatorial Africa. So
they had to get a lot of sun there.
Yeah, it would have been hard to avoid it.
What about C, vitamin C? There's some who postulate that our earliest human ancestors produced vitamin C in the liver, and it's something that we kind of evolved out of. Is there any evidence that the vitamin C was in adequate amounts back then?
Well, again, we're sort of in the realm of speculation here, but I suspect pretty strongly that our ancestors did not produce vitamin C, ascorbic acid, largely because if you look at chimpanzees or gorillas or old world monkeys, they're pretty much like us. You'd have
right.
to go all the way back to something like a lemur to find something that actually produces it.
Was there any evidence of plaque? You know, we know that some research into the Egyptians, which we know the Egyptian, the reason I'm doing the second half of the show today, coincides with this discussion a little bit. We know that the Egyptians were very much like we Americans today. They loved sugar so much they invented the toothbrush. They loved staying up late at night. Their young girls they went through precocious puberty. They had childbirth at very young ages, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so plaque has been found in ancient mummies, they say. So, and the medical orthodox like to point at that, say, see, there's nothing you can do about it. Is there any evidence that plaque was apparent in the 2.5 million year human ancestor?
Well, to be honest with you, not really. I mean, we've got evidence of dental calculus or tartar,
right?
But it's and we've got that back 2 million years. But the reality of it is, we're looking at scraps and bits of teeth. There's really very little evidence, however, for any kind of dental abscesses, any kind of, you know, related to caries. There's very little evidence of any sort of major periodontal disease. That really doesn't take off in a big way until agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah. And I figured that, you know, saliva is a direct filtrate of the blood. We know that. And we know, while the American Dental Society would like us to believe that by getting your teeth cleaned, you can protect your heart. Actually, a plaque on the teeth is corollary, not causative. And if you're getting that sort of stuff built up in your mouth, then chances are it's probably present in the bloodstream as well. Would you agree with that statement, Professor Unger?
No, at this point, you're going beyond my area of expertise.
Okay. All right. Let's do this. And you know, I can put my foot in my mouth because I don't have any accreditation, by the way. So no one can threaten to take anything away from me. I actually own the radio station, so I even have free roam on that. Anyway, let's do this. Let's take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I want to find out affirmatively what your group did find out about the diets of these early humans. You're listening to Superhuman Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Her bitch is like a bunch of rose. If I ever tell you about Maxine, your own ass.
Melatonin is the best sleep aid in the world, but it has one flaw, the delivery method. Melatonin tablets are not efficient and can wear off too soon, leaving you wide awake in the middle of the night. Time-release tablets make you feel groggy in the morning. Now there's the AgeForce Sustained Delivery Melatonin Patch. This transdermal patch delivers a precise amount of melatonin from the moment you apply it and continues to do so for an entire 6 hours. This ensures a full night's sleep while waking refreshed and ready to go. Visit AgeForce.com and use the coupon code SHRMEL and save 50% off your first order. Go to AgeForce.com and use SHRMEL today and sleep better tomorrow. CoQ10 is known to ramp up mitochondrial function. PQQ is documented to increase mitochondrial biogenesis and size. Now get two of the most advanced anti-aging supplements in a single capsule. Brought to you by Dr. Peter Rouse, CoQ10 and PQQ combined will give your body the mitochondrial energy and production that you need. And to make this offer even better, Superhuman Radio listeners get 20% off when you call 310-895-5385 and mention that you heard it on Superhuman Radio. From the most advanced supplement company on the planet, Primordial Performance, comes the new Andro series. Andro Lean is a thermogenic aid that will promote lipolysis and incinerate body fat. Andro Mass creates explosive gains and is highly anabolic. Andro Hard will turn your muscles into granite hard stone while increasing sex drive and maximizing strength. The Andro series represents the most advanced delivery systems available anywhere. These are non-methylated and completely liver safe and non-toxic. Buy one or stack all of the new Andro series products today at primordialperformance.com. All of your favorite supplements are waiting for you at the best prices and fastest customer service at orbitnutrition.com. Even some of the more popular supplements advertised right here on Superhuman Radio. They carry All-American EFX, LG Sciences, and Primordial Performance products at the best prices on the net. Visit orbitnutrition.com today and check out their complete line. Give them a chance to fill your order. You won't be disappointed. orbitnutrition.com. The best supplements in the universe are at orbitnutrition.com.
If you're like me, you avoid the insulin spike from eating pasta, but not anymore. Miracle Noodle is the world's first no-calorie, no-carbohydrate noodle. You heard me right. Now you can enjoy pasta dishes and stay on your low-carb diet. They have fettuccine, linguine, rigatoni, and more. Even angel hair pasta is now a no-calorie, no-carb food. And Miracle Noodle tastes great. So go to superhumanradio.com today and click the Miracle Noodle banner ad to learn more about how you can start enjoying pasta again, even when you're dieting. Find your Miracle Noodle at superhumanradio.com today.
No other peptide supplier has a more complete offering than Southern Research Companies. And no other peptide supplier can boast that all their research peptides are manufactured inside the United States in Tier 1 labs. Whether you're looking for IGF-1 Long R3, GHRP6, GHRP2, Melanotan 2, Mechano Growth Factor, or PT-141, or hard-to-find peptides like Triptorelin or Follistatin, you'll find them at Southern Research Companies. Free shipping on orders over $150. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Southern Research banner ad today and do business with the most trusted name in research peptides, Southern Research Companies.
Get stronger. Feel younger. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. Later in the show, we'll have Professor Kenneth Federer. professor of archaeology at Central Connecticut State University, talking about the canary in the mine. We're going to learn more about the conditions of past lost civilizations and compare them to what's going on today in the United States and see if there's any similarities. But right now we're talking with Professor Unger, Peter Unger. He's the distinguished professor and chairperson at the Department of Anthropology at the University of Arkansas. We're talking about our early ancestors and what they ate. So, Professor Unger, what did your group find out conclusively that you can say to my audience today?
Well, what we found out conclusively is that there are basically four stages, if you will, of human evolution, or four just main groups that we usually deal with. The first group lived something on the order of between 5 or 4.5, I should say, and 7 million years ago. And back then, our earliest ancestors were living in woodland environments and eating the products of the forest, probably things like fruits and stems and leaves and so on, not unlike a chimpanzee today. Then we get to the second group, which was something on the order of about 4 or 4.2 to about 2 million years ago. And that second group, they basically ventured out into the open savanna, and it looks more like most of them consumed more grass-related resources, probably grass seeds or sedges, things of that nature. And that's based on the fact that the microscopic wear on their teeth shows the consumption of very tough grass-like foods, and the isotopes, the chemistry of the carbon, shows that the kinds of foods they were eating had the kind of photosynthesis that today we find in tropical grasses. So that's the second group. So first group, woodland. Second group came down out of the trees eating grasses, cereal grains, things of that nature, although certainly not domesticated ones like we do today.
Right.
Then at about 2.5 million years ago, there was this major sort of split, a fork in the road, if you will. And that sort of was accompanied by a major change in the environment. It became much drier, and it became much more open. And grasslands spread throughout eastern and southern Africa. About that time, there were two main groups, this bizarre specialist group, robust group, which were our cousins and didn't directly give rise to us, and they became sort of super specialists on these savanna resources. But then there were our own ancestors, the earliest members of the genus Homo, and it looks like they continued to eat some of these sort of opened grassland resources, but also consumed a much broader variety of food. So rather than specializing, they became more generalist and took a broader variety of foods. They certainly consumed some tree products like fruits and stems and things of that nature, and probably also continued to consume some of the grass products, but certainly also began to eat meat. And so I think what we're seeing is in human evolution, the evidence now is mounting that having a broad diet is sort of one of the hallmarks of this major evolutionary step.
So that and that's kind of where we've come to today. I mean, we have a very, very broad diet today. Obviously, there's a lot of things in our diet that shouldn't be. But with that being said, what sparked? Is there any evidence of what sparked these changes? You know, the first group, the second group, the third group. Was it the chicken and the egg? Did we start eating differently and then evolve, or did our bodies, you think, need something different and we were seeking it out?
You know, that's sort of the $64,000, or I guess it'd be more than that, question.
I know, nowadays. Right? 64K doesn't buy much in this day and age.
No, it doesn't. I think the thing about diet is it's really key to understanding the relationship between an animal and its environment. It is what the animal is, really, basically. And the old saying, you are what you eat, is definitely true from an ecological perspective. I mean, what makes us human, what makes all animals what they are, is because of the way that they've interacted with their environment over time. And the changes that have occurred have led to evolution. And there's nothing more fundamental in terms of the interaction between an organism and its environment than that part of the environment an organism takes in to itself, to fuel itself. And so diet is absolutely key. It's absolutely central to understanding who and what we and every other species of animal on this planet is.
Well, and there is evidence. The first two groups that you talked about that were eating predominantly nuts and grass foods and so on, there's evidence that their bellies were bigger because they had to consume larger amounts of foods in order to get the nutrition out of it. And there was some writing early on, years and years ago, and I want to say that was promoted by Leslie Aiello's group at the Wenner-Gren Foundation, that it wasn't until we moved away from exclusively nuts, seeds, and stems, eating like chimpanzees, that when we started eating meat, our brain actually grew. Did you find any of that evidence in the skull cavities of these different groups, that the brain started to change as the diet started to change?
Well, that's the theory. The theory basically is that you can't have a big brain and a big gut. It's that simple. It just takes too much. It's metabolically too expensive. Brains and guts are two of the most expensive organs in the body. And if you want to grow a big brain, the idea is to maintain balance in terms of the energy equation. You've got to shrink your gut. And the only way to really have a big brain and a small gut is to consume foods that don't require a lot of processing, like meats.
Ah,
so that's the idea there,
and that's what made me pose the question, because one would think that maybe the brain, which is the brain, kind of influenced our desire, that caused us to seek out foods, because the brain, in the hierarchy of survival, we know that the brain influences everything that goes on in the body. It's the highest consumer of glucose and demands of oxygen and so on and so forth. There's evidence that some parts of the brain use as much oxygen and glucose as the legs, some small parts of the brain. So it makes one wonder if the brain didn't say, you know, we need to start eating this stuff. This is what I want because this will nourish me better and keep me out of danger. And hence we evolved. Maybe the whole evolutionary process, when the brain was driving, it was a good thing. But now, a different part of the brain is driving desire, and that is because we're influenced by advertising and we're influenced by what we're being told is what we should be eating.
Well, that's true. I mean, we do, I have to say, though, we do crave fat and sugar because those are high-energy food sources. And since we evolved in a very sort of what you might call a seasonal environment where high-energy food sources were not available all the time, then, you know, we probably evolved in a way that would allow us to take advantage of those high energy sources whenever they were there and have us crave them.
Aren't there some groups of civilization that are virtually untouched by modernization and the agricultural revolution that your group is looking to try to better understand what you're looking back at? You know, I know like the Inuit still eat high-fat diets. Are there any groups out there that you look at and go, wow, you know, these people are not very far removed from some of our ancestors when it comes to diet?
Well, here's the problem with that approach. The problem is most of the traditional foraging people that are alive today are in very marginal environments, like the ones you mentioned, like the Inuit, like the Australian Aboriginals out in the Western Desert. They're living sort of on the edge, really. I'm not sure I would take them as really great models for our own distant ancestors, largely because our own distant ancestors probably lived in more lush environments and places that we would want to live.
Right.
So that's part of the problem of using living peoples. The other issue is it really doesn't give us the answers we're looking for, because if you're going to use traditional foraging peoples as your model to understand human evolution, who are you going to look at? Are you going to look at the Australian Aborigines that consume maybe a dozen species of plants and virtually no animal protein? Or are you going to look at the historic Inuit that consumed almost entirely marine mammals as their source of energy? They're completely different in terms of their diets, and yet both groups were fairly healthy and did okay with what they had available to them. I think the reality is that's the answer. The reason 2.5 million years ago when we started to take a broader and broader and broader range of foods, we're able to tolerate all these things. And that means that we could move to all four corners of the earth and basically find something that would sustain us no matter where we went, which is one of the things I think that makes us unique as a species.
What I want to do is I want to take our last commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk about something that is actually the last question I was going to ask you about, which is kind of related to some maybe polymorphisms that occur because of the regions that our ancestors may come from and the availability of certain foods. We're talking with Professor Peter Unger. He is the distinguished professor and chairperson, Department of Anthropology at the University of Arkansas. You're listening to Superhuman Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more. The fourth most abundant mineral in the body, magnesium, is responsible for 300 biochemical reactions, normal muscle and nerve function, proper heart rhythm, healthy immune system, and proper hormone levels. But most find taking oral magnesium problematic. Get optimum magnesium levels with transdermal magnesium oil from MikeMahler.com. Magnesium absorbed through the skin can elevate DHEA levels and a variety of other reactions that can increase energy, reduce muscle soreness, lose stomach fat, and ramp up heart health. Go to MikeMahler.com today. That's Mike, MaHLER.com. I have never endorsed a training guide before The Blueprint by Rob Regish. The Blueprint combines the best techniques for building muscle and gaining strength with the best tips on supplementation and nutrition. Everyone who has used The Blueprint has surpassed their expectations in muscular gains in record time. You'll learn how to break through any plateau, how to make gains from every single workout, and all for the price of a single supplement purchase. Get your copy of The Blueprint today by going to superhumanradio.com and clicking the Blueprint banner ad. Order today and get copies of both the Blueprint 2.0 and 3.0, plus ongoing support on the Blueprint Forum to ensure your success. If you want to be superhuman, you can't eat junk. Finally, there's a protein bar that isn't just candy in disguise. Quest protein bars have 20 grams of protein, 4 to 5 grams of non-fiber carbs, and the only bars on the market with no sugar or sugar alcohols. I've never promoted a protein bar before, but these are delicious and unlike any other protein bars you've ever tried before. They're so good that Quest Nutrition is giving away 2 free bars to all my listeners, even free shipping. Go to superhumanradio.com right now and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to try them today. No other peptide supplier has a more complete offering than Southern Research Companies. And no other peptide supplier can boast that all their research peptides are manufactured inside the United States in Tier 1 labs. Whether you're looking for IGF-1 Long R3, GHRP6, GHRP2, Melanotan-2, Mechanical Growth Factor, or PT-141, or hard-to-find peptides like Triptorelin or Follistatin, you'll find them at Southern Research Companies. Free shipping on orders over $150. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Southern Research banner ad today and do business with the most trusted name in research peptides, Southern Research Company. Never before has an anti-estrogen been so powerful. The triazole formula is built on a potent, all-natural aromatase inhibitor called Pizole, which has been shown in clinical trial to be as effective as a leading prescription aromatase inhibitor. Pizole works in concert with the rest of the triazole formula to control estrogen while simultaneously boosting testosterone significantly. In fact, one of triazole's testers had a 120% increase in total testosterone and a 257% increase in free testosterone. Triazole is available at bodybuilding.com, NutriPlanet.com, or where finer supplements are sold. For more information, check out GetDS.com. Thousands of Superhuman Radio listeners already know how well GLC 2000 works at repairing joints and cartilage, and it's the best price on the market, milligram for milligram. Now GLC Direct is offering a special that my listeners can take advantage of. Buy one, get one free of any GLC 2000 product. That's right, buy one of your favorite GLC 2000 products and get one free. Capsules or raw powder. Just mention Superhuman Radio and buy one, get one free today. Call 866-452-3473 or click the GLC banner ad on superhumanradio.com. Offer limited to one per household.
Your radio just got ripped. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. My guest this hour, Professor Peter Unger. We're talking about what was on the menu for our early human ancestors. And obviously it varies. It just goes to show that the evolutionary process either drove our diet or our diet drove the evolutionary process. But either way, clearly that our early ancestors did not suffer from many of the diseases, the chronic diseases that we have today. Professor Unger, is there any evidence that there were certain polymorphisms that occurred as a result of the region, for instance. We pointed out the Inuit and their access to marine proteins as their primary. Is there any evidence that early humans ate almost exclusively what was available to them, for instance, in the way of animal proteins or marine life? Did those who had access to the oceans fish, for instance?
Well, that's a really good question. Yes, by the time we get to the species known as Homo heidelbergensis, by about 750,000 years ago, we do start to see the consumption of marine resources, both in terms of the archaeological record and in terms of some of the isotopes that we find in the teeth themselves.
Now, I know that you don't have soft tissue to look at, but is there any evidence that as a result of the introduction of marine life, that there was maybe a change in the ability to assimilate these proteins? Because we know that the people who were, their ancestors were raised in countries and regions where animal husbandry and the milking of cows occurred, that they seemed to be able to tolerate lactose. And others who don't, they tend to be lactose intolerant. Is there any evidence that, because I always talk about the ancestral diet, eat the way your ancestors ate, because that is the way your genetics evolved. Is there any evidence of that? Is there evidence that people who ate fish became better at assimilating those proteins?
Well, not that I'm aware of. That doesn't mean it's not the case, but if it is the case, then I'm just not aware of it.
Okay, all right. So where does your research take you next?
Where does my research take me next?
Yes, what will you be doing next?
Well, what we've got to do now is really start to better integrate all the different lines of evidence that we have available to us, to put together a picture of evolution over time from about the time when chimpanzees and humans split until modern humans. We've got to look at the anatomy. We've got to look at the microscopic wear on the teeth. We have to actually look at the remains of the plants, what we call the phytoliths, within the tartar to see exactly what species were being eaten. And once we start to integrate all these lines together with the chemistry and the microscopic tooth wear, we can begin to put together, I think, a better understanding of not just what our ancestors ate, but how that influenced the change in our bodies and the structures overall.
Do you think that what we ate actually precipitated the split between chimpanzees and us?
Well, that's a really good question. I would say that they were separated geographically and had different resources available to them, and then they evolved separately as a result of that physical separation and access to different foods. So in that regard, yeah, I guess food did play a role.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wonder if we could take chimpanzees and start feeding them cornflakes, McDonald's, and getting them to smoke cigarettes and get them to catch up to us.
Probably not.
No, I didn't think so. I know.
And in fact, if all you need to do is look at an orangutan in a zoo, a big fat orangutan in a zoo, and you'll know they wouldn't last 2 weeks in the wild.
Is there any evidence of what diseases were present in our 2.5 million year ago ancestor?
Well, the reality is, I did mention earlier in the program this the hypervitaminosis issue, but there's very little. I mean, there's not a lot in the way.
What about joint wear, arthritis? Was there any evidence of osteoarthritis?
No, and very little, I should say. And the reason I think is because most of them died in their teens, if not their 20s.
Why did they die so young? Was it the elements, or did they just not have longevity in them?
They got eaten.
Ah. Well, is there any evidence of any prehistoric humans at the 2.5 million mark that who were able to avoid these problems living longer?
No, not really. Most of the specimens that we have, the third molar, the wisdom tooth, was just starting to erupt and come in when the animal died or the ancestor died.
And when does the wisdom tooth come in? I'm an idiot about that because I have my wisdom teeth, so I don't know.
Somewhere between about 18 and 21.
Okay, so it's very hard to find one of these specimens older than its early 20s.
That's right. The first time that happens, we've got some older individuals starting – quite a bit later, actually. There's one individual in Dmanisi in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, but that individual may not even be a direct human ancestor. And then in Neanderthals, we've got some older individuals. But sort of at the earliest point in the evolution of our own genus, we just didn't have very much longevity. And it was largely because, you know, what are you, 4 feet tall? And you're living in an environment with 10 large-bodied species of carnivores, lions, saber-toothed cats, tigers, hyenas, leopards, on and on and on. You have no fire at the earliest point. You've got no projectile weapons. You're probably going to get eaten.
So in other words, we were prey back then.
We were prey.
I'll be darned. We don't think of ourselves that way today, do we?
No, we think of ourselves as the hunters, not the hunted.
Well, at least if you look at the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, that's true. Where are the large majority of these fossils found?
Well, the majority of the fossils that we have come from eastern and southern Africa, from the area we call the Rift Valley, from Ethiopia down into Tanzania and then into South Africa.
Interesting. Do we ever find fossilized human remains any place else, like even in the rare occurrence? Oh, look at this, you know?
Well, we get, by about 1.7, 1.8 million years ago, our ancestors found their way out of the African continent. And we get them up into China and cross into Vietnam and the former Soviet Republic of Georgia.
It's about time they figured out that if they could get out of there, you know, vote with your feet, and maybe these lions and tigers and bears would stop eating them. So I'm proud of that. It took them a long
time.
Well,
also, I mean, at that point, you've got a much larger individual. You've grown up. Some individuals are more than 6 feet in height by about 1.7 million years ago.
So that was rare back then, that to be that tall?
Well, we've only got one or two individuals with that sort of stature. Although where we find them, that's where we find really tall people today, like the Turkana people of Kenya are really tall. And the same species in Kenya of these early human ancestors, we find that same species in China, and they're short in China and tall in Kenya.
You know what amazes me, Professor Unger? I've been watching the series The Tudors recently. Watched all four seasons back to back. And it amazes me how many women died during childbirth in the 14, 1500s and so on. And I don't understand why that is when prehistoric humans, did prehistoric females die during childbirth regularly?
I assume so.
Really? I mean, so this would be seen as a flaw of the species if we give birth and the female dies upon childbirth, isn't it?
Yes and no. The reason is because we've got these monstrously large brains and we've got these very narrow pelvises so that we can walk on two legs. And those two are not a very good combination.
Ah, because the head is so large for the birthing canal, you're saying?
We are the only species that I'm aware of that actually has a neonate, a newborn's head larger than the birth canal itself. It doesn't happen except in us.
Wow. I never thought about that. I never even, really, that's amazing. Yeah,
because when you pressure for our big brain right there and the need for us to walk on two legs. If our hips were much wider, we couldn't efficiently walk on two legs. But if our brains, you know, if our babies were born much younger, so that their brains were even smaller and less developed, they'd never survive. In fact, you know, we're the only species that I know of also that has babies born so helpless that they can't even latch onto mom and grasp.
And let's face it, if they stayed in mom longer to come out more prepared, so to speak, they wouldn't even come out of the birthing canal.
That's right.
Wow, that's interesting. You know, we take so much for granted, don't we?
Yeah, well, it's a very fine seesaw. Basically, it's a very fine balance, as it were, between big brains and being able to walk on two legs. And we're sort of just at the edge. It was very common in the recent past for women to die in childbirth.
And you know what's funny? Italian women must be different because my mother's mother had 12 children and my father's mother had 14. So
right.
That's why when I've been watching The Tudors and watching how many women die at childbirth, and I'm thinking, wow, Like, was my grandfather's trying to kill my grandmothers because they had them pregnant 14 and 12 times? I mean, what was that about? And these women gave birth every single time.
Yeah, well, it's true.
Wow. Great stuff. Listen, I want to thank you so much, for coming on the show and talking about this. And I hope that, your further work is able to maybe even get more specific about the diets and some of the other questions that we talked about today. Thanks so much for coming on Superhuman Radio.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
You okay.
All right, so when we come back, we will have Professor Ken Federer from the Central Connecticut State University talking about what I like to call the canary in the mine, similarities to lost civilizations and the current U.S. conditions. This country is not in the best of shapes. There is also evidence of a small exodus taking place right now. People who have the money are leaving the country, believe it or not. What's going on? We'll find out when we come back. Thousands of Superhuman Radio listeners already know how well GLC 2000 works at repairing joints and cartilage, and it's the best price on the market, milligram for milligram. Now GLC Direct is offering a special that my listeners can take advantage of. Buy one, get one free of any GLC 2000 product. That's right, buy one of your favorite GLC 2000 products and get one free. Capsules or raw powder. Just mention Superhuman Radio and buy one, get one free today. Call 866-452-3473 or click the GLC banner ad on superhumanradio.com. Offer limited to one per household. AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your question. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn, teach, lead.
I've never felt a pump from taking a supplement. That's until I tried creatine nitrate from APS Nutrition. I expected to feel nothing, just like the NO supplements I had taken before. But this stuff really does work. Even taking below the recommended dose, I could feel the sensation of tighter muscles under the swelling effect of the pump. And the pump lasts for a few hours. It worked for me and I was a skeptic. Check out creatine nitrate by visiting APSNutrition.com today. Try it and you'll be a believer too.
Sissies may want to stop listening now. Super DMZ is the most powerful legal compound available on the market today, bar none. Super DMZ will give you lean muscle and strength gains at comparable rates to the anabolic steroid Dianabol with none of the water retention or bloat. Super DMZ contains Superdrol dimethazine, not to be confused with other Superdrol knockoffs. Get Super DMZ while supplies last at IronMagLabs.com. Don't wait too long because Super DMZ is sure to be added to the government ban list. Go to IronMagLabs.com today.
That's the sound of 37 dumbbells. That's a lot of weight and a lot of wasted space when you can get the same thing done with just one set of power blocks. The new, quieter, urethane series power blocks with FlexPin technology are the heaviest and easiest to use quick change dumbbells on the market. Starting at just $149 a pair, power blocks can grow as your strength grows, all the way up to 130 pounds per dumbbell. Imagine a whole rack of dumbbells in the space of just one pair with power blocks. Go to powerblock.com today or call 800-651-1937. Power block, the world's best dumbbell.
If you want to be superhuman, you can't eat junk. Finally, there's a protein bar that isn't just candy in disguise. Quest protein bars have 20 grams of protein, 4 to 5 grams of non-fiber carbs, and the only bars on the market with no sugar or sugar alcohols. I've never promoted a protein bar before, but these are delicious and unlike any other protein bars you've ever tried before. They're so good that Quest Nutrition is giving away 2 free bars to all my listeners, even free shipping. Go to superhumanradio.com right now and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to try them today.
This is the Superhuman Channel, where brawn and brains finally meet.
Welcome back. I've wanted to do this interview for quite some time. I had to find the right guest. You know, we talk about nutrition, we talk about training, we talk about modalities of health, we talk about a lot of things this is something that's really intrigued me. You know, the mantra of the show recently is never forget. Well, how can you even forget if you don't know the realities of some of the answers to these questions that we're going to be talking about today? My guest this hour is Professor Kenneth Fetter. He is professor of archaeology at Central Connecticut State University. Welcome to the show, Professor Fetter.
Great to be here, Carl.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Okay, I've talked about this on... We do an episode of the show called Casual Friday where I rant about what's wrong with medicine, what's wrong with the government, what's wrong. And the reality is that I have a lot of friends, some of them very, very well healed, who are for the first time talking about leaving the United States. I've actually said myself on the air that I've never thought about leaving this country because my parents came here from Italy. My father and my uncles fought in the war. They fought for this country. But for the first time, I am at a point where I think to myself, you know, this country may not have my best interests at heart any longer. Maybe I need to think about moving elsewhere. And that started me thinking about lost civilizations. I think a lot of us think that lost civilizations, all the people in a lost civilization, pick one, the Incas, the Aztecs, whoever, they just disappeared. But that's not the case, is it?
No, I mean, the fact of the matter is it's the civilizations that disappear, but the people go somewhere else.
You used the term when we first discussed this by phone. You said to me, people vote with their feet.
Right, sure. That's a phrase that I've seen used a bunch of times when discussing the collapse of ancient civilizations. And, you know, every civilization that's ever evolved on the surface of this earth that we know about in antiquity, they all disappeared. They all, in one way or another, collapse, they reconfigure, they break down into smaller groups, or people just leave. They vote with their feet. If they're unhappy with the way things are going, if they don't think the government, the people above them, have their best interests at heart, they find some other avenue. They walk away.
So let's give an example. One of the lost civilizations that you're very well versed with. Which one can we talk about?
Well, anyone of a number of them, ancient Egypt or, say, the Maya here in the New World.
I like Egypt, and I'll tell you
sure.
why I like Egypt, because there are a lot of parallels to
sure.
the early Egyptians and United States. They had decadent lifestyles. They embraced sweets. They liked to stay up late at night. their young girls went through precocious puberty and gave birth young. They worshipped certain things that we worship here, and their governments were, by and large, slightly corrupt.
Right.
So let's talk about ancient Egypt. How powerful of a civilization was ancient Egypt?
They absolutely were. They were the equivalent of the United States of 4,000 or 4,500 years ago. They had very powerful, dominant political, dominant economically, dominant militarily, and their reach was very, very far. And there were other civilizations in the old world at that time, and they fought wars and they cobbled together alliances. But fundamentally, Egypt, all roads led to Egypt. You know, the old phrase, all roads lead to Rome.
Right.
Well, that really was true for Egypt 4,500 years ago.
So Egypt actually was influential in other nations.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You go up and down the Nile, countries to the south were developed because of, or at least in response to, what was going on in Egypt. People in the Middle East were responding to Egyptians' military might and their trading and their desire to get resources from other places. So everybody in the old world, you draw a circle around ancient Egypt and it goes out for 1,000 miles. All those people, in one way or another, were affected by what was going on in the Egyptian civilization.
Now, how long did the Egyptian civilization actually survive from its early records of its inception
right.
as a major power to when it just fiddled away?
Yeah, when you're looking at the Giza, the place where the three pyramids that are the biggest
right.
pyramids ever built, you're looking at something that's about 4,600 years ago. And there, that civilization, it ebbed and flowed. It wasn't always dominant. It was dominant for a while, and then it fell a little bit. Then it rose up again and fell. By the time you're looking at just even a couple of thousand years ago, they were no longer the big dog. They were no longer the major game in town. They were, you know, when you read about Cleopatra and those guys, by that time, Egypt was viewed as that their time on the stage had sort of ended. and they were a secondary power. They were not quite a third world nation, if you use our modern phraseology,
right, right.
But they were secondary. They were not primary at that point. So they lasted for a couple of thousand years for sure, maybe 3,000 years, something like that. A lot longer than we've been around. But, you know, it's nothing but hubris. It's nothing but our lack of humility that allows us to believe, well, we're not like them. We'll last forever.
Well, that's probably
what they thought too.
I hate to say this term because it's publicized by the media, too big to fail, but they talked about the banks being too big to fail, the American car makers being too big to fail. And I think there's a notion that by sheer will alone, that this nation is too big to fail.
Right. Well, you know, we may think that, but probably every great civilization that dominated their region throughout history, they believed that too.
Right.
And it didn't work.
That's the fatal flaw, in my opinion. The beginning
right.
of the end is when you think that you can't fail, and that is when you start to misstep, misjudge, and pay the price for those things. Now, let's talk about early Egypt for a moment. Let's kind of extrapolate a little bit. What were some of the greatest pitfalls that you see when looking back at the demise of the Egyptian civilization?
You know, just let me answer that in a broad way, okay? And
okay.
then I'll answer it specifically. When I was, you know, thinking about what we were going to talk about today, I went to my list of reasons ancient civilizations decayed or fell apart. That I, you know, say, oh, this is a list I give my students. It's a list I include in a couple of my books. Let's see if, you know, this is going to be reasonable for us to talk about. And the scary thing is, as I'm going down the list, Carl, every one of the reasons that we've given for why ancient civilizations declined or collapsed are things that you turn on the TV and you hear people talking about these very things
yes.
regarding our civilization today. And so the same kinds of things that we see going on in Egypt 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, we're talking about that, at least the general things, every day on cable, every day on the news, every day in newspapers. These are the concerns that we have. Egypt, like every civilization, Egypt developed in an area where they had some resources, but they needed other resources. They
uh-huh.
didn't have everything they needed wasn't right there. You know, for example,
oil.
There weren't a lot of trees in Egypt.
Right.
But if you need logs for construction, for building boats, well, you got to trade for it. So there are people up in Lebanon, they got a lot of trees, but we have to, you know, be in good terms with them, and they have to be willing to sell us their trees, and that's all well and good, but what happens when the people in Lebanon say, you know, you're not paying us enough for our trees? We want more. Do you go to war with them? What if they embargo trees? You know, it's kind of like us in oil.
Right.
Well, you know, we need more oil. We need oil, and we get it from Canada, we get it from Russia, and we get it from the Middle East. But what happens when that spigot gets turned off? What happens when the price goes up? Just like ancient Egypt, when things like that happen, things got out of balance and out of whack, the same things are happening to us. And one of the metaphors or analogies I give in my class is that a civilization like ancient Egypt that was building these huge pyramids, they could only do that because their social and economic system was like a pyramid. Real few, very, very powerful, wealthy people up at the top.
Right.
A whole lot of people doing a whole lot of work, building pyramids, planting crops, supplying for the wealth of the people at the very top. And as long as the people at the bottom were sort of content with that, they said, well, we have to work real hard, but the military protects us from enemies. We have to work real hard, but the police force protects us from criminals. You have to work real hard, but they have they keep the roads built, they keep the roads clear. And as long as that, you know, the people on the mass of people at the very bottom say, all right, we're giving up a lot, but the Pharaoh, he's like tied into God, and he's controlling everything, and things seem to be doing okay, we'll go along with it. But then, you know, what happens in Egypt happens everywhere else. You know, there are more people who want to be higher than lower. There's graft. There's theft. And people at the bottom, this mass of people, feel like, you know what? We're not getting a good deal anymore.
Right.
That's when people start voting with their feet.
What's funny? I say on this show all the time, I use the phrase, the power is in the base of the pyramid. I say that all the time. Yes, when I talk about people not wanting to eat GMO foods, I say, well, we vote with our dollars. The power is in the base of the pyramid. If we stop buying this stuff, then companies like Monsanto will stop making this stuff. The power is in the base of the pyramid. And what you just said reinforces what I've been saying all along on the show. We have to take a commercial break.
You bet.
I've got lots of great questions for Professor Ken Fetter We're going to be talking more about the what I like to call the canary in the mine. Is the United States the next lost civilization? Actually, I think that we have a lot of the resources that we need to turn it around, but it's going to take people, the base of the pyramid, to steer this ship in the right direction. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. 6-Oxo is back thanks to Iron Mag Lab, the gold standard for testosterone boosting and estrogen reduction that all other over-the-counter aromatase inhibitors are compared to is 6-Oxo progesterone. 6-Oxo is the active ingredient in the new E-Control RX from Iron Mag Labs. Iron Mag Labs has resurrected the beast that has been clinically shown to raise free testosterone by as much as 226%. As men age, estrogen rises and testosterone drops. E-Control RX can help reverse this from happening. E-Control RX is suitable for post-cycle therapy to jumpstart natural testosterone production. Get E-Control RX today. Go to ironmaglabs.com today. Anabolicminds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your questions. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit anabolicminds.com today and get into the action. Anabolicminds.com. Learn, teach, lead. Sissies may want to stop listening now. Super DMZ is the most powerful legal compound available on the market today, bar none. Super DMZ will give you lean muscle and strength gains at comparable rates to the anabolic steroid Dianabol with none of the water retention or bloat. Super DMZ contains Superdrol dimethazine, not to be confused with other Superdrol knockoffs. Get Super DMZ while supplies last at ironmaglabs.com. Don't wait too long because Super DMZ is sure to be added to the government ban list. Go to ironmaglabs.com today.
I've never felt a pump from taking a supplement. That's until I tried creatine nitrate from APS Nutrition. I expected to feel nothing, just like the NO supplements I had taken before. But this stuff really does work. Even taking below the recommended dose, I could feel the sensation of tighter muscles under the swelling effect of the pump. And the pump lasts for a few hours. It worked for me and I was a skeptic. Check out creatine nitrate by visiting APSNutrition.com today. Try it and you'll be a believer too.
Protein is the building block of muscle. Protein-rich diets have been shown to not only be heart healthy, but also burn body fat through the thermogenic effect of protein in the digestive process. But getting enough protein each day isn't easy. That's why I use True Protein from TrueProtein.com. TrueProtein.com has an incredible variety of flavors. My favorite is chocolate coconut. And you can even create your own custom blend. Mix whey, casein, and egg, or throw in a little beef isolate. And you can save 5% off the already low, low price when you use the coupon code SHRADIO. Visit TrueProtein.com today and let them know Carl sent you. No other peptide supplier has a more complete offering than Southern Research Companies. And no other peptide supplier can boast that all their research peptides are manufactured inside the United States in Tier 1 labs. Whether you're looking for IGF-1 Long R3, GHRP6, GHRP2, Melanotan-2, Mechanogrowth Factor, or PT-141, or hard-to-find peptides like Triptorelin or Follistatin, you'll find them at Southern Research Companies. Free shipping on orders over $150. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Southern Research banner ad today and do business with the most trusted name in research peptides, Southern Research Company.
Build muscle, burn fat. It's Superhuman Radio.
She's a very kinky girl.
Welcome back.
The kind you don't take home to my vibe.
We're talking with Professor Ken Fetter.
She will never let your spirits
from Central Connecticut State University. We're talking about lost civilizations and what parallels there are to our current conditions here in the United States. Are we the next lost civilization? We're going to find out here in a couple minutes. Okay. Professor Fetter, we were talking about, when we went into the break, the base of the pyramid, the
right.
People being destroyed. You know, part of I am not a political person by nature, but I find myself becoming more and more politically active. Because I personally feel exploited by the current government.
Sure.
And I was listening to public radio this morning on the way into the studio, and I heard these pundits going back and forth about, you know, well, when we figure taxes, they should be figured this way. When we figure taxes, we should be. What I don't hear anyone talking about today, unfortunately, is what is being done with our tax dollars? Why is there no accountability to the people? And this makes me feel exploited. And I think
right.
That there's a common, is there any evidence that that was the straw that breaks the camel's back in a lost civilization where people go, you know, I don't have to live like this. I'm getting out of here.
Well, you know, the interesting, I was watching the cable news this morning and seeing all this coverage of Occupy Wall Street and all these things all over the country, all over the world, in fact. And I don't know how your listeners feel about it. We don't, you know, that's sort of beside the point. But one of their arguments is we're now living in a society which 1% of the population owns like 35% of all the wealth, and that the other 99% are just left behind with whatever, you know, with whatever's left behind, that's what we get. And I think that what they're expressing is something that is absolutely diagnostic of all the ancient civilizations that have ever been studied, that there's this huge concentration, all this tax money, all this wealth, all this extra stuff that people have gets siphoned away from them and flows up the pyramid. And the deal is what breaks the camel's back, I think, are a number of things, and it depends on the individual society. But, for example, when the military is no longer doing its job, if you say, listen, we're willing to pay all these taxes as long as we're not invaded by our enemies, but if then every once in a while their enemies invade and they burn our cities, and we say, well, wait, what are we paying all these taxes for? I thought that's what that was for.
Right.
And if, like, law and order breaks down and people can't walk through the cities without getting robbed, and they say to themselves, wait a minute, my taxes keep going up. They're supposed to be protecting me when I walk through the streets of the city, but it's not happening. So all the things that this pyramid with all of us at the base, that it promises that even though you're at the base of the pyramid, you will get these benefits. When those benefits are no longer being delivered, people at the bottom say, hey, wait a minute. And that's when people start occupying Wall Street. In that the same equivalent thousands of years ago, when Teotihuacan, which is pre-Aztec in Mexico City, it's before the Aztecs.
Well, right.
When these guys started falling apart, when the upper levels of that pyramid weren't giving the lower levels of the pyramid their due, when we see the neighborhood of the wealth is burned to the ground. So there's actual revolution going on when that top tier isn't doing what they promised to do for everybody on the bottom. But you know, sometimes it's not necessarily their fault. Natural catastrophes happen. Volcanoes erupt. There are earthquakes. There are tidal waves. And in ancient societies, it was even worse because they thought, hey, you know, Pharaoh,
right.
He's the god. He's tied into God.
God, yeah, and right.
So
they believed that God, right.
Yeah. So if he's got God's ear, but there's a volcanic eruption anyway, well, what's up with that?
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
not doing what, again, we're not getting sufficient benefits from all this tax that we're paying. And that's why you got people walking around saying, listen, I'm paying 35% of my income, and what do I get in return? I'm getting nothing. Some people are getting really super fat, and all the rest of us, again, are just have the scraps. And you get to a point where, I don't know if Occupy Wall Street is going to go any further than a bunch of people sitting around complaining about things. But certainly there are examples in history and prehistory of people getting mad enough that they just sort of, they gum up the works, they gum up the system.
Well, you know what? About 7 years ago, I was in the gym with a bunch of friends and we were talking and this discussion came up, you know.
Right.
No one is happy with the way the government is running the country, blah, blah, blah. And the truth of the matter is I am nonpartisan in this.
Sure.
I don't believe that Democrats or Republicans have any of the answers we need as people today. And I'm sorry
right.
to say that because I believe that the people who choose to be politicians today choose to be politicians because the same reason that some people become rock stars. They just want a high-level position that guarantees them a lot of wealth and access
right.
for their families to solidify that their families are in that top tier forever and ever.
You
that's
got
what it is.
Sure.
Okay. And that's how it's been since the beginning of days. I mean, let's face it. This hasn't changed. If you go back to American forefathers, they were talking about this. If you go back to the Tudor dynasty, they were talking about this is not change. This is inherent in human condition, period, end of story. But, you know, when I think about these kind of things and I think about the conditions of our country today, for instance,
right.
I start to wonder if there's any chance that we really, as a people, is there any evidence in past civilizations that were about to implode where the people said enough is enough and they actually took control? And I don't mean by revolution because that's not possible in this day and age any longer. But there is a way to control through our dollars. We can stop spending on the things that we spend. Is there any evidence in past civilizations where they're about to turn the corner and the people didn't let it happen?
Well, you know, here's I've got a kind of an answer for you, and that is that in the past, anyway, what has often happened when these societies were about to fall apart is that some technological fix shows up. We're suddenly now, oh, wait a minute, we can defend ourselves better. We can build better roads. I'll give you an example of that. In the United States, look at the U.S., back in the 1800s, the vast majority of people were relatively poor and lived on farms. And they were needed to produce food for the very few people who were up on top, right? But you know what? Agricultural technology kept improving. The numbers are really kind of amazing. Back in 1920, one farmer could produce enough food for eight other people. So eight other people didn't have to live on the farm. They didn't have to be farmers. They could be doctors or lawyers or architects or radio hosts or archaeologists.
Right.
That's in 1920. By 1980, that same farmer could produce food enough for 80 people. 10 times more. So that meant there was that much more, he was that much more efficient at producing this big surplus that could feed a lot of people that allowed wealth to be created. In 2010, that number is double again. It's like 160.
Wow.
So as long as agricultural technology kept allowing there to be fewer and fewer people producing much more efficiently, a lot of this extra stuff, that growth in wealth it kept increasing. But the question is, what happens if climate change is real and suddenly?
Wait. We don't even have to go that far. Something is happening, and I'm glad that you raised this point. Actually, the methods of animal husbandry today are producing sick animals that make the people who eat these meats sick. The methods of farming today are producing foodborne diseases that are killing and hurting people and nutrient devoid foods to begin with, and we are seeing an increase in chronic disease that is directly related unequivocally to what we put in our mouth. So it's already happening, what you're about to say. So now what?
So what I was saying there is that the increase in technology has been all about increasing the amount of food, not necessarily the quality of food.
Right.
So you got these people making the beef cattle grow faster by giving them antibiotics, right?
Right.
And so we're ingesting those antibiotics, and who knows what that's doing in terms of the flora and fauna in our gut, and whether or not all these bacteria are now getting resistant because they're you know, through an evolutionary process, they've been exposed to this bacteria, and only the ones that aren't susceptible to them survive. So yeah, you're right. The deal in food technology has always been produce more and more and more, not worried so much about the quality of the food.
Right.
So yeah, that's another parallel issue, which is what happens when the food we're eating is the equivalent of cardboard, and we can fill our stomachs, but we're chronically sick.
Well, let me give you a snapshot of what I believe.
Sure.
Actually, I'm actually going to have an opportunity to be on a couple mainstream media TV shows in the next few weeks, because this is something that I'm complaining about and worried about. By the year 2030, it's estimated that 50% of the population will be considered clinically obese.
Unbelievable. Huh?
Obesity is tantamount to disease that could A, disable a person, and absolutely B, cause chronic illness that then makes them dependent on the current medical system, which is A, not working, and B, can't be funded. So what we have basically, and the analogy that I give all the time, is you've got a car, and it's going uphill, and all of a sudden you've been straddled with towing this mass behind you, and you're like, okay, it's a lot of weight, but I can do it. I got an 8-cylinder, and you continue up the hill, and all of a sudden, halfway up the hill, you find out that half of your cylinders stop working. Now, when half of the cylinders in a car stop working, it's not just that half the cylinders no longer contribute to the energy the engine is producing, but actually the other pistons have to keep the ones that are not working moving. So it actually, not only does it not contribute, but it pulls away. Now you have a situation where your car is going backwards down the hill, and it's going to end up at the bottom of the hill in a heap of rubble and mess. That is exactly what is going to happen in 2030 if we stay on this track. And we know that the obesity is related to the food that we're eating.
Right.
A point in case, you point out the antibiotics. There is several good studies that now show that Animals that are not given antibiotics don't grow as fast.
Right.
There is evidence that antibiotics lead to obesity. What mechanism, we're not sure yet. So that means that the humans that are eating these residual antibiotic-laden
right.
meats, they're getting obese from the antibiotics. So we have a healthcare debacle. And I hate calling it healthcare because that's the wrong word. But we have a problem in the United States where disease is going to take over. And the people and the pyramid is actually going to be cut in half. We're not going to look like a pyramid. We're going to look like a diamond very shortly, where there's a few people at the bottom working and healthy. And then there's this big mass in the middle that's sucking everything dry. This is what I'm worried about now as far as the United States goes.
Right, yeah. I mean, another way I look at it, too, is that every civilization that's ever existed, and I know this is an overused metaphor, but it is, it becomes like a giant Ponzi scheme.
Yes.
You know, where you have a Ponzi scheme, right?
Yeah, you have a few.
Listen, 10 people send me 10 bucks, and they ask 10 people to send me, you know, them 10 a buck, and then they send it to me, and I get the person at the front of the line gets all of this wealth.
Right.
And people under that may get some money, but you need an ever-increasing number of people at the very bottom
right.
to feed it. And in fact, after a little bit, mathematically, you run out of enough people in the world. Well, that's what's happening. You know, ancient civilizations, you know how they solved that, Carl, is they went and invaded their neighbors and grabbed all those people and said, okay, you're our peasants now. To increase the number of people working at the very bottom of that pyramid to feed the people up on top. And you know, I love our country, and we have a philosophy of stuff flowing from the top down, and a philosophy of more people being able to raise themselves up in terms of social, political, and economic characteristics. And we want more people. We want a big middle class. But the thing is that the pyramid doesn't work that way. The Ponzi scheme doesn't work that way. We need an ever increasing number of people at the bottom to feed the desires and the appetites of the people further up. I mean, even you look at how many people at the bottom of the pyramid, you know, everybody wants an iPad. Everybody wants a nice car. Everybody wants, an iPhone. And it's like, is there enough wealth in the universe to support that?
But you know what? There shouldn't be. And you know what? Look, the problem with society today, I want to come back
sure.
on track here when we come back from the break, but I have to say this. The problem with society today is a sense of entitlement that is promoted by the government. And we look at entitlement programs.
Right.
And look, we're not all going to get iPads. We're not all going to have million-dollar homes. We're not all going to have the being tied to this illusion that your life is somehow less than because you don't have those is really the problem. It's
sure.
a disillusionment. But let's do this. Let's take a quick commercial break. I want to talk to you about, is there any evidence of disease actually causing people to start to abandon their governments and their homes to flee to higher ground,
right.
so to speak? We're talking with Professor Ken Fetter. We're talking, this is called the canary in the mine, similarities to lost civilizations and the current U.S. conditions. You're listening to Superhuman Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Sissies may want to stop listening now. Super DMZ is the most powerful legal compound available on the market today, bar none. Super DMZ will give you lean muscle and strength gains at comparable rates to the anabolic steroid Dianabol with none of the water retention or bloat. Super DMZ contains Superdrol dimethazine, not to be confused with other Superdrol knockoffs. Get Super DMZ while supplies last at ironmaglabs.com. Don't wait too long because Super DMZ is sure to be added to the government ban list. Go to ironmaglabs.com today. Melatonin is the best sleep aid in the world, but it has one flaw, the delivery method. Melatonin tablets are not efficient and can wear off too soon, leaving you wide awake in the middle of the night. Time-release tablets make you feel groggy in the morning. Now there's the Age4 Sustained Delivery Melatonin Patch. This transdermal patch delivers a precise amount of melatonin from the moment you apply it and continues to do so for an entire 6 hours. This ensures a full night's sleep while waking refreshed and ready to go. Visit ageforce.com and use the coupon code SHRMEL and save 50% off your first order. Go to ageforce.com and use SHRMEL today and sleep better tomorrow.
I've never felt a pump from taking a supplement. That's until I tried creatine nitrate from APS Nutrition. I expected to feel nothing, just like the NO supplements I had taken before. But this stuff really does work. Even taking below the recommended dose, I could feel the sensation of tighter muscles under the swelling effect of the pump. And the pump lasts lasts for a few hours. It worked for me and I was a skeptic. Check out creatine nitrate by visiting APSNutrition.com today. Try it and you'll be a believer too.
AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your question. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn. Teach. Lead.
If you're like me, you avoid the insulin spike from eating pasta, but not anymore. Miracle Noodle is the world's first no-calorie, no-carbohydrate noodle. You heard me right. Now you can enjoy pasta dishes and stay on your low-carb diet. They have fettuccine, linguine, rigatoni, and more. Even angel hair pasta is now a no-calorie, no-carb food. And Miracle Noodle tastes great. So go to superhumanradio.com today and click the Miracle Noodle banner ad to learn more about how you can start enjoying pasta again, even when you're dieting. Find your miracle noodle at superhumanradio.com today.
6-Oxo is back thanks to Iron Mag Lab, the gold standard for testosterone boosting and estrogen reduction that all other over-the-counter aromatase inhibitors are compared to, is 6-Oxo progesterone. 6-Oxo is the active ingredient in the new E-Control RX from Iron Mag Labs. Iron Mag Labs has resurrected the beast that has been clinically shown to raise free testosterone by as much as 226%. As men age, estrogen rises and testosterone drops. E-Control RX can help reverse this from happening. E-Control RX is suitable for post-cycle therapy to jumpstart natural testosterone production. Get E-Control RX today. Go to IronMagLabs.com today.
Listen strong. It's Superhuman Radio.
Well, you can be the first to hear this. The new flavor being presented by Quest Protein Bars today. It's one of the new natural flavors, so that means it does not have sucralose at all in it. It's lemon cream pie. I can't wait to taste it. I got to tell you, every single protein bar that comes out of Quest tastes amazing. Lemon cream pie sounds wonderful to me. My guest this hour is Professor Ken Fetter, and we're talking about what I like to call the canary in the mine. So, Professor Fetter, is there any evidence that disease, you know, the plague and so those sort of things caused people to lose faith in their government and seek other places to live?
Well, there are a couple of ways of answering that. Can't answer that directly, but here's the deal. One thing that we know is that there were whole civilizations that because of epidemic diseases, that their populations dropped so precipitously, you know, so quickly that the need for that big base population, well, it was gone. And so the civilizations collapsed because the people who were at the base were all dead. We have evidence in North America, for example, of very sophisticated Native American civilizations who, after contact with Europeans with their smallpox and influenza and other infectious diseases, the populations dropped 85 or 90%. So it's not like the civilizations were destroyed because people walked away. People died in such great numbers that the civilization was no longer tenable. And you know, there's a whole subfield of in archaeology and anthropology called paleopathology, where you look at the skeletons that you find in ancient sites and burials and look at their health status. And what's kind of remarkable, and it's universally true, when you compare people who had a hunting and gathering way of life, these are folks who every day they have to wake up, they have to go out there and gather whatever wild foods there are to hunt, to fish, and so on. And compare their health status, what their skeletons look like, to the skeletons of especially the early agriculturalists. These are folks who are planting crops and eating corn, beans, and squash, or eating wheat and rye and oats and stuff like that. The bizarre thing, wholly unexpected, is that the hunters and gatherers, the older ones, they're in better health than the agriculturalists.
We just actually, the first half of this show today, I interviewed Professor Peter Unger. Group just published a study looking at what early humans actually ate, and we differentiated. And I said to him, if you had to pick a time where the diet was optimal. And he said, well, what do you mean by optimal? I says, where the diet did not precipitate disease, where the diet was complementary to the human condition. And he picked between 2.5 and 1.7 million years
ago. Is that right? Sure.
Yeah. He said before grains were introduced, before a lot of these foods that were go-to foods to feed the masses.
Right.
When humans were eating the way they were more complementary to their genetics, so to speak.
Right, sure.
And so you're right. And it's funny that you talk about that, because that's one of my pet peeves. That's why I'm doing this show, because we have politicians out there who are talking about fixing health care.
Right.
But no one is talking about fixing health care without addressing and stopping the reason that people are getting sick in the first place,
it's a Band-Aid approach.
No. You know what it's analogous to? I say, if your home was burning down, and while it was burning down, I came into your home and I said, you know what? We should paint these walls green. And you'd look at me and say, but the house is on fire. I don't want to paint the walls. We need to get the hell out of here and stop the fire. No. Let's talk about painting the walls while the house is burning down. That is as ridiculous a concept as me saying, well, we're going to fix healthcare by shifting these dollars here and paying for this. And guess what? Meanwhile, I got this big hole in the boat. The water's coming in faster and faster. And you're telling me about we're going to buy better buckets. That's not the answer. Let's plug the hole first.
For sure. Yeah. But it's true. You know, when you look at what Peter Unger was talking about, you look at the skeletons of the early agriculturalists, and their anemia rates based on the porosity of their bone, very high. Their teeth are a wreck from all those carbs that they're eating, and they're not brushing their teeth. They don't have dentists,
well,
so their teeth are falling apart.
The Egyptians, getting back on track here, the Egyptians invented the toothbrush. There was no decay. But also the Egyptians loved sugar, and they loved staying up late at night.
You know what's funny, too, is that a lot of those foods that we love so much but that are bad for us were at one time only available to the upper classes.
Right.
So you have there's evidence in, say, in ancient Japan that if you compare the teeth of really poor people, of peasants, to the teeth of the emperor and his family, the peasants are in much better health because they don't have access to all these sweet sugary things. Well, the emperor has it all he wants.
Right.
And so when you look at the two skeletons, you go, wait a minute, these people are actually in better shape than this guy is.
Right.
But you're right. A lot of agriculture has focused on increasing the number of calories you can produce from an acre of land, not, are these complete proteins? Is this healthy for you? It's feeding more people so they can work on, so they don't have to work on the farm, but they can build pyramids, or they can serve in the Pharaoh's army, or they can be in a road crew. And it's all about filling their stomachs so they can work the next day and not really worried about what the long-term effects are going to be.
That's a
problem in every civilization. If people are not healthy enough to do the work that needs to be done, the civilization is going to fall
apart.
And
that's why I am saying that our biggest challenge today is not terrorism. It's not oil. It's not bailing out the banks. It's the rising rate of obesity, because what's happening is the only reason why this country has been resilient is because its people, you and I, the people at the base of the pyramid, are resilient. We produce. We keep fueling the economy so that this
Absolutely.
Government can make mistake after mistake after mistake. Well, guess what? When 50% of our base of our pyramid is on the government dole because they're disabled and because they're disease ridden and they're no longer producing, this is, the Ponzi scheme comes to an end once and for all. 2030 is the year they're predicting for 50% of the population. I want to do something real quick.
Sure.
I want to plug your book. You have a book called Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries. It's science and pseudoscience and archaeology. It's in its seventh edition. It's published by McGraw-Hill. And that's a book that, you know, listen, I've been teaching for more than 30 years, and archaeology is a popular topic, and it's on, you know, you see cable documentaries all the time, and it's on TV all the time. So I noticed that a lot of kids were coming into my classes with all kinds of misconceptions, you know, that they thought the Egyptians were inspired by extraterrestrial aliens, or that everybody learned civilization from Atlantis, and there's no archaeological evidence for that. And it bothered me that there wasn't a good book available for students and just for people interested in the human past. And so back in 1990, I wrote this book on that covers out and out frauds in archaeology, mysteries about the past, and we still have a bunch of them. And put that book together. It's done real well. It's in its seventh edition. If people are interested, you can get it on Amazon or any of the online booksellers. Sometimes it's in bookstores. And it covers some of the things we actually talked about today, about how civilizations evolve and what happens to them when it reaches that tipping point, as you were talking about, where there just isn't enough wealth to support them. The whole thing falls over and people either die in large numbers, or they just walk away, or they fight a revolution, and then some other civilization rises, and they think they're going to last forever, and they don't.
Okay, so the people can get that at Amazon.com.
Absolutely.
So are you telling me that Stonehenge was not created by aliens?
I got to tell you, it was not created by aliens. It was plain old people. I mean, one of the things about you know, we're talking about human resilience, a phrase that you use.
Yes.
Is that when human beings, and this is the optimistic part of our conversation.
Yes.
When human beings work together and cooperate, and they have a clear goal in mind, you know, we can accomplish a lot of stuff. Stonehenge, and these are a bunch of people who are just with the muscles on their bodies were able to lift these stones that weigh tens of thousands of pounds because they had a common goal, a common theme, and they were working together. The same is true of the Colosseum in Rome or the Egyptian pyramids.
Right.
So we are capable of remarkable things
But the problem, as I see it, is this, and I've talked about this for years, even before I was on radio.
Right.
We as a people do not have the ability to mobilize our opinions. Unless there is a political campaign going on and we're inspired to walk into a booth and pull a lever. Short of that, we can't get together. And if people could mobilize their opinions, and I don't care if 50% of the population feels this way and 50% of the population feels that way, even if we were able to come to the conclusion where we have two opinions about things and we act on one and see if it works, and if not, we act on the other. But we have to do that, because what's clear to me right now is that government, which is made up of regular people like you and I, maybe not even regular people. Some of them, I think, maybe actually a little less adequate in the IQ area, but let's leave that alone. But government is made up of regular people like you and I, and the reality is that they have no innate abilities to run this country any more than you or I. And why shouldn't you and I be involved in the process of running this country? This
For
is
sure.
supposed to be, that's what this country was supposed to have been founded on, but it has gone far astray. We're going to take, I'm sorry?
I was just going to say, and you know what? That's at the heart of the Tea Party movement and the Occupy Wall Street. Whether you agree with one or the other or neither, it's a bunch of people saying, you know what? We're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore.
And that, you know what? And I can't imagine any American not feeling that way today. I can't imagine any American going, you know, I'm really, well, that's not true. I can imagine that the people who are in political power today are saying, I'm happy. My family is protected. My job is protected.
Right.
I have access to wealth. I have access to the right people. I'm sure that they are quite pleased with the way things are going. But the base of the pyramid has to feel exploited in this day and age. And you know what? Maybe it's time for us to walk away from the country. That's what I want to discuss when we come back with Professor Fetter. You're listening to Super Human Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Next door, you know? I don't know what to do.
So it wasn't
you. All right.
Protein is the building block of muscle. Protein-rich diets have been shown to not only be heart healthy, but also burn body fat through the thermogenic effect of protein in the digestive process. But getting enough protein each day isn't easy. That's why I use True Protein from TrueProtein.com. TrueProtein.com has an incredible variety of flavors. My favorite is chocolate coconut. And you can even create your own custom blend. Mix whey, casein, and egg, or throw in a little beef isolate. And you can save 5% off the already low price when you use the coupon code SH Radio. Visit TrueProtein.com today and let them know Carl sent you.
You already know how great the Testo 100 Transdermal Testosterone Boosting Patch is. Well, now it's even better. The new and improved Testo 100 patch now contains D-aspartic acid, stinging nettle root, and androstenotrione to increase free testosterone while reducing sex hormone binding globulin and aromatase enzyme. It's still made in FDA-certified labs and contains all the great ingredients that made it work originally. But now it's even better. Bypassing the stomach to deliver its ingredients throughout the day for greater increases in energy, libido, and muscle-building, fat-burning effects. Get 50% off when you use the coupon code SHR4. Go to AGEFORCE.com and use the coupon code SHR4 and get your new Testo 100 patch today.
I have never endorsed a training guide before The Blueprint by Rob Regish. The Blueprint combines the best techniques for building muscle and gaining strength with the best tips on supplementation and nutrition. Everyone who has used The Blueprint has surpassed their expectations in muscular gains in record time. You'll learn how to break through any plateau, how to make gains from every single workout, and all for the price of a single supplement purchase. Get your copy of The Blueprint today by going to superhumanradio.com and clicking the Blueprint banner ad. Order today and get copies of both The Blueprint 2.0 and 3.0, plus ongoing support on The Blueprint Forum to ensure your success.
From the most advanced supplement company on the planet, Primordial Performance, comes the new Andro series. Andro Lean is a thermogenic aid that will promote lipolysis and incinerate body fat. Andro Mass creates explosive gains and is highly anabolic. Andro Hard will turn your muscles into granite hard stone while increasing sex drive and maximizing strength. The Andro series represents the most advanced delivery systems available anywhere. These are non-methylated and completely liver safe and non-toxic. Buy one or stack all of the new Andro series products today at primordialperformance.com.
All of your favorite supplements are waiting for you at the best prices and fastest customer service at orbitnutrition.com. Even some of the more popular supplements advertised right here on Superhuman Radio. They carry All-American EFX, LG Sciences, and Primordial Performance products at the best prices on the net. Visit orbitnutrition.com today and check out their complete line. Give them a chance to fill your order. You won't be disappointed. orbitnutrition.com. The best supplements in the universe are at orbitnutrition.com.
Thousands of Superhuman Radio listeners already know how well GLC 2000 works at repairing joints and cartilage, and it's the best price on the market, milligram for milligram. Now GLC Direct is offering a special that my listeners can take advantage of. Buy one, get one free of any GLC 2000 product. That's right. Buy one of your favorite GLC 2000 products and get one free. Capsules or raw powder. Just mention Superhuman Radio and buy one, get one free today. Call 866-452-3473 or click the GLC banner ad on superhumanradio.com. Offer limited to one per household.
Build muscle, burn fat. It's Superhuman Radio.
It was summer, summertime in Northern Michigan.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. I don't know about you, but I cannot wait to taste the new Quest protein bar, lemon cream pie. I love lemon. You know, you get two free Quest protein bars by visiting superhumanradio.com and clicking the Quest protein bar banner ad. Two of these amazing bars will be shipped to you absolutely free. I promise you, you will never eat another protein bar once you taste the Quest protein bar. My guest this hour is Professor Ken Fetter. He is not only a professor of archaeology at Central Connecticut State University, but also the author of Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries, Science and Pseudoscience and Archaeology. You can get a copy of it at Amazon.com if you want to enhance your intelligence.
There you go.
And we all want to enhance our intelligence. Okay, so Professor Fetter, how long did it take for, let's say, the final collapse of the Egyptian Empire? Did people leave quickly, or was this over a long period of time?
It was over a long period of time, slowly but surely, in competition with other civilizations all around them. That just sort of the feet moved one way, the wealth moved one way, the power moved one way, and slowly but surely they became less and less significant a force in the ancient world.
Did the people in power, in political power then, did they end up prospering anyway and just go away, or did they end up losing out because the country fell apart, or the civilization fell apart?
Well, you know how it works is they're the last one.
Professor Fetter, are you there? I just lost you, if you can hear me. Gosh, I want to hear this answer so badly. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to play a little music. We'll continue with this music really, really quick, and we'll get him back on the line. So sit tight.
It was summertime in Northern Michigan. We'll be right back.
Okay, we've got Professor Fetter back on the line.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, live radio is a wonderful thing. Anyway, you know, it was actually the perfect timing, too. You were just about to give the answer, and you just went dead, and I was like, oh, my God, this is... I wish I had a couple commercials to run right now.
But there anyway. You go.
Okay, people were listening intently as I was. You were about to say, when I asked you if the people in political power lost out or they prospered anyway when the their civilization that they were controlling fell apart.
You know, the people on top always manage to buffer themselves, at least initially, from the bad stuff that's happening. So that they're the last ones. They're still eating cake, right?
Right.
While the poor people are downtrodden and they're starving to death. But you've got your, as long as your military is willing to defend you, as long as you've got something buffering you from what's going on, ultimately they lose out too. But man, they hold on to that that sense of entitlement as long as they possibly can.
But I gotta believe that once, there's a mass exodus, considering that the base of the pyramid is what is producing, the only thing
right.
that's producing. You know, governments have no money. They have dollars that they take from people.
Exactly.
And so once the base of the pyramid starts to disappear significantly, I have to believe that paying your army becomes difficult, doing anything becomes difficult. And I got to believe that politicians, let's face it. If your money becomes worthless, and what you have is American dollars here that are already starting, you know, the threat that the American dollar is starting to topple.
Right.
Okay. That's the first sign, they say. Once the money starts to become worthless, that's when the implosion occurs.
Right.
Who cares if you have a ton of money? What does it matter? It's worthless.
Right, exactly. Yeah, every government system ultimately works on a basis of consensus, you know? Everybody has to buy into the notion that they're doing something good for me. I benefit from all those tax dollars. I benefit from serving in the military. I personally, my family benefits. When those benefits start disappearing, where I'm not getting anything out of this, people, right, they move out, they just don't pay their taxes. What are you going to do if 99% of the people say, we don't opt into this system anymore, we want change? There's not a lot the people on the top can do. You know, it's all, you know, governments can only rule by acquiescence, by people saying, yeah, we agree with this. And in cases in the past where that bond broke, those civilizations disappeared. They collapsed.
Okay, so now my next question, and I don't know that you are prepared to answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Right.
Is there any evidence of civilizations where governments were not corrupt and truly did rule or run countries with the input of the people? Or is there even evidence today of that?
You know, my best answer is I wish I could say yes, but I can't. You know, it's from the very origins of civilization, Carl, when that first group of people said, you know what, we need to build a wall around our village because of bad guys out there. But we have to give a couple of people power to control this because we can't just do it willy-nilly. And you give power to a couple of guys and say, listen, when we're done building the wall, you'll be just like us again. And say, sure. But then those people, you know, get a taste of power, a little bit better, you know, food than anybody else because they're more important suddenly. And then when the wall's built, everybody goes, okay, now you can come back down here and be like us. And they say, no, actually, we need to be on top here to maintain the wall, to make sure that the gods support us. So we really need a bigger house than you. We really, when we die, we should have a bigger burial than you. And we should be able to tell you not just how to build a wall, but how to plant your crops and what you need to donate to the army. And you know, once that happens, once those individuals taste that power, they never want to give it up. And I think maybe it's just you know, human nature that nobody wants to be egalitarian. Nobody wants to be equal to everybody else. Everybody wants a little bit more. And as a result, these guys are just not willing to give up that control.
I've quoted Henry Kissinger on the show numerous times when talking about these types of issues. And Henry Kissinger once said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And this is evidenced all the way through the beginning of time. And it's happening here in the United States today. We are at the mercy of governments as they like us to think, but that's not true. We do control governments with our spending. The problem is that people are not willing to do the hard work quite often up front, but they're going to have to do the hard work later. I talk to people all the time when I'm in the sauna, we get into these discussions. I say, you know what? If the American people decided, I'm not going to go to work for the next 5 days, and I'm not spending a dollar for the next 5 days. I'm going to sit in my home. I'm going to look out the window. I'm going to read. I'm going to be quiet. If 50 to 75% of the population did that one thing for 5 days, just five simple days, right. Don't go to work. Don't worry about losing your job. Don't pay any bills. Don't go out. Don't buy gas. Don't do anything. Don't leave the house for 5 days. You will hear a shuddering, vacuous sound coming out of D.C. of all the politicians scurrying going, holy crap, they figured it out. They're in control. What do we do now?
It would certainly get their attention.
Oh, my God. Look what happened with the banks. You know what? That wasn't purposeful, but if people stopped paying their mortgages for a couple months and put the money in an escrow account and said, I have the money to pay my mortgage, but I'm not, I'm quietly dissenting about the way this government's running the country, the banks will run to the government and go, you better get these people happy because we need that money.
Right.
So we do control things, but none of us are willing to do the marginally hard work or get together as a group other than that day when we pull the lever to vote another politically corrupt person into power.
Well, and you and I both know that the problem, one of the problems is the minute they get into office, they're working to get reelected. And so they have to make everybody happy. Maybe one of the solutions here would be I want somebody to run, say, listen, I have a lot of decisions that have to be made. I'm not going to be popular, but I don't care because I'm not going to run for reelection. So you can hate me all you want, but these are the steps that have to be taken.
You know what they call
nobody
that?
Nobody has the guts to do it.
Well, you know what they call that? They call that Ron Paul. And you know what?
Okay.
I got to tell you something. I am not a political person. I'm probably a political dummy. I have a good friend named Al who is very politically involved. He knows. I mean, I talk to him, and the guy elucidates things to me, and I go, my God, I never even thought about that. He's
right.
The most intelligent, my childhood friend, and he is so politically intelligent, and he's so politically involved. And I know that he likes Ron Paul. He says, I love Ron. He says, but he can't get elected because of his isolationist approaches. But I actually think that we need an isolationist for a short period of time. We need to retract all of our support of all these other countries and go, you know what? We really need to take care of our people first. Sorry. I know we promised your army $1.2 billion this year. I'm not going to get it. We need to do the tough love things right now that no one is willing to do and not be popular.
Yeah.
Because that is the right thing to do.
Sure. I mean, it is true, again, when you look at ancient civilizations, a lot of times one of the biggest problems they have is they overreach.
Yes.
You know, they need military outposts in every place in the world, and eventually they can't support that. They don't have the money to do that, and people become dependent on that and reliant on that, but it doesn't work in the long run. So,
right. Well, we have two options, folks. As Professor Fetter points out about previous civilizations that have gone by the wayside, we can either A, do the very, very difficult thing of voting with our feet, which means leaving everything behind, your home, everything, just picking up and going to another place and starting over again, which none of us really want to do. Or, considering the fact that this country really pretty much has about 80 to 90% of all the resources we need to survive without anybody else's help, we can start doing the marginally hard work of voting with our dollars. I say somebody out there organize a day, a week, 5 days. I will not come in and do this show for 5 days. I will stay home for 5 days. I will not spend a dollar for 5 days. I will stay home for 5 days. The whole country needs to stay home for 5 days, not go to work, not do anything, and bring the country to a halt once and for all so that they remember again that the power is in the base of the pyramid.
There you go. Hey, Carl.
Yes.
Just one exception, though. During that 5 days, nobody's spending any money. They can still buy my book, right?
Yes. That is the only exception to the rule.
Thank you very much.
No, no, no.
I appreciate
that. No. Ken, I have to be true to my – here's what I say. Right before you take your five-day sojourn, buy the book and spend 5 days home reading Ken Fetter's book. Give the book name again.
It's Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries, Science and Pseudoscience and Archaeology.
There you go. Get it at Amazon.com, but make sure that you get it into your home before the 5 day time frame begins. How's
that
sound?
Perfect solution. I agree with that 100%.
Listen, Ken, thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, this was great. Thanks so much. Really interesting conversation, Carl.
I'll send you a link so you can pass it around to your colleagues. How's that sound?
Fantastic.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Take care. All right, so there you have it. I also want to thank Professor Peter Unger for coming on and talking about the menu of our early ancestors. I hope that you got a little something out of the show, a little more than you bargained for. We cannot be a nation of superhumans if the nation is not allowing us to. So we have a lot of hard decisions to make. We'll see you tomorrow with another great episode of Superhuman Radio.